Sure, that's perfect. Okay.
I'll come
Yeah.
in. I'm also load shaded here. I'm using my phone and I'm about to go to the
Sure,
car.
That's perfect.
I was telling them that, you know, people will see you sitting in a car and you are charging your phone and having a meeting there.
Hey, you are trying to get the network. If you are in the car, it's much better than being in the house.
Yes.
Chair, six members.
We correct now.
Chair, six
That's
members.
Right, Chair.
Okay. Let me get ready. We correct now.
Chair, six
That's members. Right, Chair.
Okay. Let me get ready. We correct now.
Chair, six
That's
members.
Right, Chair.
Okay. Let me get ready. We correct now.
Chair, six
That's
members.
Right, Chair.
Okay. Let me get ready. We correct now.
Chair, six That's right, Chair.
Let's start with our meeting. Let me welcome members of the committee, stakeholders who are here to get responses from Treasury and SAR.
Welcome members of the committee.
Welcome the support team of Parliament,
to get
the media,
from,
and all in attendance.
The
meeting is officially open.
Welcome the
are there apologies?
Of, Parliament.
The media
from,
and all
Chair, we haven't received any apologies.
Officially open.
Are there apologies?
No apology.
The
okay. Let's move to the
Chair,
next,
we haven't received
item,
any apologies.
Which is the response
no apology.
By National Treasury and SAR to submissions received on the draft rates and monetary amount and amendment of revenue laws bill and the draft revenue laws amendment bill. You have got 1 hour, 10 minutes. Let me also welcome you, Treasurer and SARS. And if ever there are other entities which are in attendance,
you are welcome.
Thanks. Over to you.
And if ever there are other entities which are in attendance.
Morning, Chair.
Thanks. Over to you.
And thank you very much for allowing us to come to this meeting to present our response. As indicated during the public consultation process, this is a draft response document. The final response document is normally tabled after the bill is tabled. So this is the draft response document on the based on the public hearings and public workshops. After the bill from Treasury, so we've got our team. We've got Ms. Makgoshi Legete, DDG Tax and Financial Sector Policy. We've got Christopher Axelson, Chief Director, Tax Policy. We've got me, and we've got our team members. We've got the team, our directors, who will be doing the, and we've got our team who will be leading the discussions because they are experts in the field. So I'm gonna start doing the consultation process. to say how far we are, where in the field, like how did we get to here. So in terms of the consultation process, today we're dealing with the draft rates bill and the draft revenue law amendment bill. Tomorrow we will be doing the response on the draft TLAB and TALA. In terms of the consultation process, the draft rates bill was first published on the budget day and it gives effect to the rates and monetary thresholds to income tax tables, as well as increases on excise duties and alcohol and tobacco. It also contains changes to the fuel levy as tabled by the minister on 31 March and 31 May, as well as the postponement to the health promotion levy. So after those two amendments were made, the draft rates bill was also published again for public comments on 29 July. So the draft revenue laws amendment bill contains the changes to the income tax in relation to the two-pot retirement system. And these changes follow the public comment. These changes follow the public comments that were received on the draft discussion document that was published by National Treasury on 15 December 2021, as well as announcements by the minister both in the budget and in the MTBPS on the introduction of the two-pot retirement system. Next slide, please. As well as announcements by the minister both in the budget and in the MTBPS on the introduction. With regard to the two-pot system, before we even made changes to the bill, National Treasury did undergo a consultation process with only the relevant stakeholders to discuss the issues. And then on 29 July 2022, the draft revenue laws amendment bill was published for public comment, and the closing date for public comments of the draft rates bill and the draft revenue laws amendment bill was 29 August 2022. This is in line with the 30-day public comment required. We received 27 comments from 27 organizations and 80 individuals. It is important to note that the 80 individuals were commenting mainly on the two-pot retirement system. And during the public consultation process this year, it was nicer because we were having comments from individuals who were not tax practitioners, who are contributors to the pension fund, and who will be affected by the bill. So they were asking comments, and the public consultation was very engaging, and we welcomed that. So we had workshops with the stakeholders on the draft rates bill on the 8th, and the two ports, we had the workshops on the 12th of September. It was the whole day workshop. That's when we received all the valuable comments from the taxpayers. On 13 September 2022, public hearings were held in Parliament, both on the draft rates bill and the draft revenue laws amendment bill. Today, on 20 September, we are doing the response to Parliament. As indicated, this is the draft response. The final response is normally tabled with the bill. In terms of the process, after we have finalized, after we have submitted the draft response, we will be making changes to the draft bill before the bills are tabled in Parliament. Thank you, Chair. I'm going to hand over to Mpho, who will be dealing with the draft rate bill. Thank you, Chair.
Good morning, Chairperson, and good morning, honorable members. I'll be taking you through the draft responses to the comments we have received on the draft rates bill. As you may well be aware that in the February budget, the minister made announcement with regards to the increases on excise duties ranging from between 4.5% to 6.5% on both alcohol and tobacco excises. The comments that we have received, the first comment was around the announcement that was made by the minister with regards to the review process that National Treasury was undertaking on the excise framework related to alcohol taxation. The taxpayers were concerned that the paper has not been released, and we are left with only 6 months to the next budget. So therefore, they are concerned that we won't have enough time for consultation. We note the comment, and National Treasury is currently busy finalizing the alcohol review paper. And once that is completed, all the stakeholders will be informed, and a consultative process will be initiated. And on this point, I would just like to indicate that we will not introduce any major reforms to the framework without first engaging in the consultative process. So taxpayers, their fears should be allayed with regards to the reforms. We will engage with them first before we implement those. So taxpayers, and then their fears should be allayed. Again, there was an issue that was raised that there are many factors that drive people to drink alcohol, and therefore it is not related necessarily to affordability and therefore driving or using excise policy to try to address this underlying problem will not solve the problem. Therefore, targeted policies and interventions are needed to drive to address the specific drivers for why people consume so much alcohol. We partially accept that the issue of alcohol abuse is driven by a lot of factors, but again, we just want to highlight that excise policy is quite an important tool in also addressing issues related to alcohol consumption. And there are other non-tax measures that are also important in dealing with the other cost drivers, the cause for alcohol consumption. The WHO has identified the policy best buys, and that includes increasing alcohol beverage excise, and also looking at enacting and imposing bans around at alcohol advertising, and also looking at enacting and imposing restrictions around the availability of alcoholic beverages. Another comment that we had received was around the compound effect of implementation of excise in terms of how is the industry apply the excise in terms of the supply chain. To say that since the excise is applied duty at source, at the manufacturing gate, once then the industry engages in excise recovery through the supply chain, that excise is compounded, and when it gets to the final consumer, the rate is much higher than what was initially charged as an excise at the factory gate. We note what the industry is saying, but we just want to indicate that we apply a specific excise duty rate at the factory gate, because from an administration point of view, it makes the system much easier that we collect excise at the factory gate. It's unfortunate that, unfortunately, National Treasury or SAS, we cannot prescribe how then the industry recovers that excise through the supply chain. If they apply markup in terms of the supply chain, in terms of recovery, it's not something that we can prescribe as SARS or National Treasury. So there's nothing we can do with regards to that. We cannot dictate how they should do the recovery of that. Again, there was a comment that given the excise increases that has been made in the previous years, government should make a commitment around maintaining a stable excise policy over the following 5 years. because then the taxpayer consider that to give investors a clear indication and policy certainty around the exercise, and therefore enable them to plan. And we cannot accept that. And I think because the exercise policy is in place to increase exercise duty rate by at least inflation on an annual basis, or looking at the targeted incidence, whichever is higher. And again, I think government cannot make a commitment that will seek exercise for the 5 years. I think the budget announcements are made on an annual basis, and they look into the whole fiscal framework and considerations that are taken into account of what government needs to do. So fixing into excise duty rate for 5 years is not something that the government can commit to. Another comment was that fixing the industry last year, if you remember, Chair, we had increased excise duty rate by 8% across the board. The industry welcomed the differentiated increases that we have implemented this year, but then they raised concern or disappointment around the low increase on wine compared to beer and spirit, and therefore they feel that there is favorable treatment given to the wine industry, and therefore we need to address the inconsistencies in the excise framework. We note the comment from the taxpayers, but also we would like to indicate that the review process is underway will look at all of these issues around the way these different categories are treated from an excise point of view. But again, we want to highlight the issue that currently beer accounts for about 75% of total alcoholic beverage consumption by volume. And also, when you look at the absolute alcohol content consumption in the country, beer again is the dominant alcoholic beverage in terms of its contribution towards absolute alcohol consumption in the country of around 51%. So wine contributes substantially less than that, but we note that the comments that have been raised and that will be taken into consideration in the review process. Next slide. And again, the other issue that was raised with regards to the way the exercise policy framework is currently implemented was that currently wine is taxed on a per liter basis, beer and spirits are taxed on an absolute alcohol content basis, and therefore the comment was to recommend that we do away with taxation of wine based on a per liter basis, that all alcoholic beverages must be taxed on an alcohol content basis, because the industry feels that creates a distortion in the excise system. We note the comments that have been made by the taxpayer, because I think, I mean, in theory, yes, the taxation of alcoholic beverages should be based on alcohol content, because that is the externality that we are looking at in terms of reducing alcohol harm. However, in reality, the excise policy structures implemented globally look at other factors are included in terms of the tax instrument that is used for these alcoholic beverages. And the application, therefore, of low excise duties on a per liter basis for wine is not unique to South Africa, and it is basically prevalent, especially in most wine-producing countries that you look at. As an example, in the European Union Directive, you have the minimum rate set for wine at zero, and you have a higher rate for beer and even higher for spirit. In a sense, it sets out the structure in terms of how excise policy should be implemented. It's also on a per liter basis for wine, but we do note the comment, and in terms of the review, we'll look at how then we can reformulate if needs be the issue around that. But just to say that this is not unique to South Africa in terms of how that is done. Again, there was an issue that the customs and excise administration, the way it's done in terms of the rules for the payment of excise by the different manufacturers, it says that 30 days is given for the beer industry to make payments of excise, whereas other or spirituous beverages are given more days, like 130 days to make payment. So therefore, they feel that there should be a uniform application of the rules with regards to excise payment. We know the concern, especially from the beer industry around that, but just to indicate that the current differential excise duty payment basically looks at the unique product characteristics of this beverage, and given that duty is the excise duty is collected at the factory gate using duty at source, the lengthy maturation period for wine and spirit means that the industry gets to be charged a levy or the excise at the factory gate, but in terms of the recovery process for both wine and the spirit industry is much longer because of the maturation period for these beverages, but that is not applicable for beer, which when excise is applied at the factory gate, the product can be readily sort of dispensed in the market and be able to recover the excise quickly, rather than unlike in the case of wine and spirit. That's why, therefore, there is the differences. But SARS quickly published a discussion paper in 2019 looking at the intention around reviewing and exploring a uniform payment terms during the process of rewriting excise legislation. And they are taking that into account. But the system as it is, it is such that wine and spirit have a longer lead time in terms of the payment because of that maturation period. Next. And then again, this was an issue that was raised around the number of tariff items that are there in terms of the customs and excise schedule. The system, the way it is with those many tariff items, it makes administration a little bit complicated and burdensome for taxpayers. And the recommendation there was that we should be looking at maybe simplifying that, and also that will make it much easier for SARS to administer and also allow the industry to innovate, especially the beer. And here, Chair, I just indicate that we don't accept that the system, the way it is complicated, and it's not complicated, it's not the way it is because we necessarily want to make the system administratively burdensome, but just to indicate that the current tariff headings and tariff classification it is based on the internationally harmonized system classification of the World Custom Organization, and also it's aligned with the Liquor Products Act that is administered by the Department of Agriculture and Reform and Rural Development, which regulates the alcoholic beverages. So those tariff items are important in terms of identification of the different products, the alcoholic beverages that are there in the market. And then again, the suggestion that taxation of alcoholic beverages on an alcohol, on absolute alcohol basis will simplify the tariff item. It is not true because the these specific items or alcoholic beverages will still need to be uniquely identified because these products are not homogenous. So they need to be identified using this internationally harmonized classification system, and also there's a requirement that was put around 2015 that any new product that is introduced in the market, that the industry will need to get the tariff determination from SARS to make sure that the product complies with the Liquor Product Act, because they need to get a certification from the Department of Agriculture, Land Reform and Rural Development to say that whatever product that they are introducing, it complies with the regulations, the liquor regulations, and then SARS will issue a tariff determination to indicate the product classification for that. So that's a requirement, and it will still stand. Next. There was an issue to say that I think the industry welcomed the differentiated excise and a much lower excise duty increases this year compared to last year when it was 8%. That is noted. There was an issue again that was raised around the increases over the years to say that they have surpassed the benchmark that we have set for tobacco, especially because we are looking at the most popular price category, which is in this case using Peter Stuyvesant, therefore that the excise increases have surpassed the 40% benchmark that we use. We note the comment, but again, as we have indicated last year, to say that when we increase excise and the industry does not reflect those excise increases in the prices of the product, you will have a situation where then the excise incident is much higher than the prices that are on the market, because the price increases do not reflect the excise increases, and therefore so that's what it is, and how the industry deals with this excise increases. Sometimes they absorb that, so there's not much we can do about that. There's a question again that was, or a comment that was raised, and a recommendation that the National Treasury should look at revising the base for especially looking at the cigarette category. That currently we are using Peter Stuyvesant as the most popular price category, and that Peter Stuyvesant does no longer is no longer relevant in terms of the current market. It just basically lost market share. Therefore, we should not be using it as a benchmark to set a price. And the recommendation was that we should look at the application of a weighted average price to use for that. And here, like we had indicated last year, that we don't accept the proposal around using the weighted average price, because what that is going to do is that the current excise duty rate will mean, therefore, that the excise incidence or the excise burden currently will be close to 100%. And I think that is sort of, I suppose, what the intention of that comment is, so that National Treasury should start looking at scaling back on the excise duty range. And I think National Treasury, we don't envisage a situation where there is a reversal of the current excise duty rate. So we don't accept that. But again, there's a policy process that we are going through in terms of the review of the policy framework on excise on tobacco products. So we'll look into that. But I think we are not envisaging reducing the current excise duty rate, because again, going to weighted average price means that I think the industry will also make a point around the high incident rate. And I don't think we want to go back to or reversing the current excise duty rate that is implemented. Next slide. And then again, there was an issue around the illicit trade. And I think this is the issue that is raised all the time, and we are aware of it and concerned about it. That currently we deal with the macroeconomic environment, and that is worsening, and consumer affordability that has gone down. That the prevalence of illicit products in the market has gone up. Again, some of it I think might be as a result of measures implemented during the COVID under disaster management, that therefore there's a problem of illicit trade, and we know the comment and we acknowledge that there's a problem of illicit trade that undermines the health and excise policy objective. But again, we don't think that the issue of illicit trade can be solved by excise duty rate. But again, this issue of illicit trade also involves an element of criminality that is involved and needs to be dealt with regards to effective enforcement and compliance measures that are implemented. And SARS has done a number of investigations and work around focusing on tobacco, gold, and then fuel industry. And then again, it has resulted in some enforcement actions that have taken place. And I think that is widely publicized what SARS is doing with regards to dealing with non-compliance in that and pursuing those who are involved in this criminal pursuit. Another comment that was raised the current gap between the legal market and also the products that are found or are sold in the market in terms of the price gap. And the recommendation was that we should be looking at enacting legislation that will implement minimum retail price for a pack of cigarettes at around 32 rand, because there are products that are sold in the market for about 7 rand per pack of 20. And I think we know that the recommendation, and we think that the issue around minimum unit price, I think it will be quite a new policy instrument in terms of the current excise policy regime that will be looked into in our review process. And I think this policy instrument can assist in terms of dealing with a lot of illicit products or cheap products in the market, because they undermine the health policy objective and excise policy objective. So it's something that is worth considering. And then again, on the issue of illicit trade, that we should be looking at implementation of a track and trace system. Similar to what is currently being implemented in Botswana, and then this system must basically be compatible with within the whole of SACU, since the excise policy is common for SACU members. And we note that the comment around the implementation of a track and trace system, the Department of Health is leading government with regards to the matter of ratification of the World Health Organization's protocol to eliminate illicit trade in tobacco products. And as part of that protocol, once it's ratified, South Africa will be required to consider as appropriate and consider developing a practical track and trace system that will be able to secure the distribution system and assist in investigation on illicit trade. And the Department of Health, they are busy with that process to get government to ratify the protocol. Another issue that was raised that we must continue to take a balanced approach in terms of excise increases because that it has an impact on affordability issues and again the issues around illicit trade. We know the comments because I think this comment was given in the context of the 8% increase that was done last year, but this year it was much lower increases that were implemented. We know that. And another comment was that illicit alcohol trade is not only a problem that is linked to lack of enforcement, but very much influenced by decisions made at the policy level. And it's not only the challenge that can be solved by the South African Police Service or the or SAR, but the responsibility of National Treasury, the Department of Agriculture, Land Reform, and also looking at the Department of the Trade and Trade Industry and Competition, as the regulatory bodies for alcoholic beverage. We know looking at that comment and agree that the problem of illicit trade needs a concerted effort from all the relevant role player that includes all the regulatory bodies within government to be able to deal with it effectively. Next. That includes all the. Thank you very much. Bodies within government to be able to deal with it. Younger.
Thank you, Chair. We are done with the rates bill increase in excise duty on alcohol and tobacco. I don't know whether we must continue. We must continue or we must pause for discussion before we go to the health promotion levy.
I think maybe Umpo can carry on.
Okay, thanks, Yaga. With regards to the delay, the increase in the promotion levy, as you might well be aware that in the budget, the February budget, the minister announced an inflationary increase of 4.5%. on the health promotion levy to take effect from the 1st of April 2020, but then it was announced okay, should I continue? Okay. So the minister announced an increase in the health promotion levy to take effect from the 1st of April 2022. Okay. And that announcement was also accompanied by an announcement around the start of the consultation process around the lowering of the current threshold that is applicable to in the health promotion levy design. of programs per 100 mil, and also the extension of the current health promotion levy to 100% produce, as we have indicated initially when we implement the health promotion levy, that we will have a temporary exemption of 100% produce. So the announcement was made around the extension of the health promotion levy to cover 100% produce. But on the 1st of April, after consultation between the Minister of Agriculture and Reform and Rural Development and the Minister of Trade and Industry and Competition, the Minister of Finance released a statement that the health promotion levy increase will be implementation thereof will be delayed to next year to allow for further consultation around the proposed extension and the lowering of the threshold. The comments that we have received was that there was some disappointment that Treasury had to postpone the inflationary increase to the health promotion levy, and that there was sort of like lack of transparency and accountability around how that around that's done. We note that the comments, and I think the minister made pronouncements around the postponement to the next year. So I won't say much about that. With regards to another comment that we have received was that the National Treasury must include efforts to raise the HPL to the 20% that was initially proposed in the 2016 discussion document that we published, and also around the expansion to produce and lowering the threshold. The comment was that there's growing evidence to show that the health promotion levy or the tax is the most cost-effective tool in controlling consumption of healthy food, and therefore it's vital that it's increased and inflation is accounted for in terms of the increases. We note the comment, and also again the others who welcome the decision to delay the vote or to postpone the increase in the health promotion levy to next year to allow for consultation process to take place. We note the comments thereof. Thank you very much. To next year to allow for consultation process to take place.
Thank you, Mpo.
We note the comments.
Okay, Chair, we're going to now move to the comments on the two-pot retirement system. Last week in Parliament, during public hearings, there were a lot of comments in this regard. We have tried to incorporate all the comments in the draft response document. So some of the comments we will combine. So if taxpayers feel that maybe some of the comments are not taken into account, they can contact us. But what happens is that we don't say in the response document who commented on this, who commented on this. And then we normally combine similar comments so that we can do one response document. So the comments, Chair, on the two parts as well as the members, we have separated them into two. There are comments on tax policy issues as well as comments on broader retirement policy issues. Alvina will be doing the comments on broader retirement policy issues. Over to you, Alvina. Thank you.
Thanks, Yanga, and good morning, everyone. Chris, can you just go straight to the comments?
Over to you, Alvina.
Don't think we'll cover the background. Okay, so obviously what came out tops was the implementation date proposed for 1 March 2023. That it would not be feasible given the system changes, rule amendments, and a whole lot of other processes that needs to take place before the two-pot system is implemented. we accept the comment. We will postpone through the legislation the implementation date from March 23 to March 24. A lot of the comments are welcomed and are supported the two-pot system. However, there were concerns that workers will resign if come implementation date access is not allowed. So we accept the comment. We will consider allowing once off seeding capital from accumulated benefits into the savings pot to enable members to be able to have some access. Next slide. Accumulated benefits. Okay, the proposal to include public sector funds was accepted and supported. However, there were concerns that the legislation, the draft bill, does not provide detail in terms of how the two-pot system will apply to defined benefits. We accept the challenges that are raised, and we are aware of the challenges that are raised with defined benefit funds. We will engage on a consultative process with defined benefit funds, as well as the relevant stakeholders, to consider options on how we cater the public sector funds, especially your defined benefit funds, into the two-pot system. There was clarification required on whether the two-pot system, the savings pot, will allow flexibility on the one-side contributions into that pot. We accept the challenge of allowing flexibility with contributions into the savings pot. The further draft bill will clarify that one-third of a member's contribution have to go into the savings pot without any flexibility or opting out of that pot. There was also clarity sought on the 12-month withdrawal period, whether it's a tax year or financial year or calendar year. The intention will be clarified in the bill that the 12-month period is a rolling 12-month period. Next slide. Okay. Clarity was also sought on the 2,000 minimum withdrawal, on whether it's gross or net of costs and tax. The policy intent is for the 2,000 to be a gross amount. Necessary clarity will be provided in the draft bill. And also, there would be instances where a member exits a fund and leaves amounts that are less than 2,000 in the savings pot, for example, when a member resigns or gets retrenched. It would be an administratively a challenge for funds to keep track of those small amounts that are left behind in the savings pot. We will amend the bill to allow for small amounts that are left behind, smaller than 2K, when a member exits the fund to be commuted. Or if a member comes back, if there is that choice, the member has less than that, the 2K that can be transferred to the retirement pot. But smaller amounts can be commuted when a member leaves the fund. Okay, there was also some concern on the 165K, the de minimis threshold that is supposed to be annuitized when a member reaches retirement, on whether this amount is a cumulative amount or it applies per pot. The policy intent is for the 165 de minimis threshold to apply on a cumulative basis for amounts that need to be annuitized from the retirement pot, as well as the two-thirds that would need to be annuitized in the vested pot. We will make the necessary amendments to reflect this intention. Amounts that need to be annuitized from the retirement pot, as well as the two-thirds that would need to be annuitized. There was also some ambiguity in terms of whether the two-pot system is mandatory or funds can choose whether to effect or implement the two-pot system. Participation, the intention, policy intention is for participation to be mandatory for all funds. So all funds have to restructure their savings in terms of the two-pot system. The bill will be amended to reflect this policy intention. There was also some concern that the funds the bill seems to be explicit that costs need to be deducted from contributions. However, industry practice is that they could deduct funds from contributions and fund values. So we will clarify this in the bill. And the last comment on that point was on investment strategy as well as the Regulation 28, whether it will be applied per pot or across all pots. We note the comment. We will clarify this. It needs to be addressed and raised with the regulator. The bill, the Revenue Laws Bill, or the Income Tax Act is not the appropriate mechanism to deal with this concern.
We will clarify this. It needs to be addressed and raised with the regulator. The bill, the Revenue Laws Bill.
There was uncertainty on the Provident Fund members who are or were over the age of 55 as at 1 March 21. These members who have a vested right, whether they have a choice to participate in the two-pot regime or whether it would be automatic for them, similar to all other members, to participate. So on this point, the intention is for members who are 55 and older as at 1 March 2021 to be given an option to either continue contributing into their vested pot or to participate in the new regime. So only these members are given that option. If they continue contributing into their vested pot, it means they do not take up the two-pot system. But if they decide to take up the two-pot system, no further contributions would be allowed into the vested pot. And if they have to remain in that same fund for them to protect their vested right that was received as of 1 March 2021. Another comment on Provident Fund members was the interaction between T-Day vested rights. So members who are younger than 55, as at 1 March 2021, they have a vested right, and there is this gap where they have non-vested right. So there were clarity was sought in terms of what happens to their vested right and this non-vested pot. So as it relates to that matter, the vested pot, as defined in the legislation, it reflects or includes both vested and non-vested rights and before the two-pot system gets implemented. Can we move on to the next slide?
Vested and non-vested rights.
Okay, and then the two-pot strategy was also sought on the impacts of the two-pot system regime on Section 37D deductions. So these would be your pension-backed housing loans, divorce order settlements, maintenance orders, as well as any other amounts due by a member to an employer. So we are currently engaging with the FSCA in terms of amending the Pension Funds Act to cater for the two-pot system changes. So it won't just be 37D deductions that need to be changed. There are other provisions in the PFA, the Pension Funds Act, that need to be amended to cater for the two-pot system. However, the current policy thinking is that deductions, 37D deductions, be catered for from the vested and the retirement pot when a membership is terminated or when a divorce order settlement becomes due and payable. And the last comment on that slide is is that clarity be provided whether various pots can be delinked when a member transfers. So if you have a vested pot, a savings pot, and a retirement pot, if you can delink the savings pot and the retirement pot from the vested pot and transfer to another employer fund or another fund. So we'll provide the necessary clarity here. The intention is that all pots
be transferred as is,
to another
and transfer from one fund to another has to be in an instance where a member terminates service with the employer providing that fund.
Transfer from one fund to another has to be in an instance where.
Okay, we have a request for legacy retirement annuity products to be exempted from the two-pot system regime because of the complications around the complexities around these annuity products, which were entered into quite many years ago. So on this matter, we will engage on a consultative process with the regulator and the relevant stakeholders to better understand the complexities here before we can amend the bill accordingly. Okay, and then we got requests that members that get retrenched or that resign not be locked in. Their retirement pot savings not be locked in,
then
they be allowed withdrawals from the retirement pot. So we partly accept the concern or the dilemma here, especially given our high unemployment rate when a member gets retrenched, especially because that event is not in the member's control. So we will be proposing limited income based withdrawals from the retirement pot when a member gets retrenched. It will be subject to certain conditions. For example, if a member has a vested pot and a savings pot, those have to be utilized first, and also access to UIF benefits will have to be exhausted first before this limited income based withdrawal can be permitted from the retirement pot.
And also access to
on the treatment of late or arrear contributions, the understanding here is that it's just a late contribution. It has to be split in terms of the two pots. That is, if those contributions are late post-implementation. If it's late contributions before the implementation date of the two-pot system, then they have to go into the vested pot. They have to be like allocated accordingly.
Contributions are late post implementation. If it's late contributions before the implementation.
Thank you, Alvina. We are now going to do comments on tax policy issues. We wish to state that there were comments on technical drafting. In view of the fact that some comments on technical drafting are informed by tax policy issues and broader retirement policy issues, we have not incorporated some of most of the comments on technical drafting, because unless the policy is clear, then drafting will follow. Over to you, Mali and Chris. Thanks. We have not incorporated.
Thank you very much, Yanga, and thank you, Chair and committee members. Okay, so the first comment that we wanted to address here is the automatic allocation of contributions. We propose that any contributions in excess of the deductible limits would not be allocable to the savings pot, but only to the retirement pot. Many commentators indicated that there were prohibitive administrative constraints for them, and therefore we accept the comment. The administrative constraints are sufficiently onerous for us to withdraw this proposal. So as a result, there will be a proposed change to the definition of the savings pot, and in particular, the amendments that were proposed to Section 11F will be withdrawn. Related to that matter, one of the proposed remedies for this problem was to apportion the tax-free contributions between the savings and the retirement pots. That part we do not accept. We think that it creates new complications because these two pots are treated differently in terms of tax. Moreover, from a horizontal equity perspective, it would put the retirement system on a much more favorable footing than other savings products, even other tax-favored savings products. So therefore, we would suggest that non-deductible contributions only be offset against future years' taxable income and lump sum payments from the vested pot or the post-retirement annuity, and all of that occurs via Section 10C.
Thank you. That non-deductible contribution only be offset against
the second set of comments dealt with the technicalities on a death or retirement of a member or beneficiary of the fund, and the way that we drafted it. It is enabled for annuities, and the technical comment there is that we should also enable it for lump sum payments, which we accept, and we will make changes to the draft revenue laws amendment bill to allow the possibility of either. And in the case of an annuity payment, it means that it will then be taxed at marginal rates. But we just also want to note that the member or the beneficiary, if it is triggered by retirement, the member will also have the option of transferring the remainder of their savings pot to the retirement pot. Then it was suggested by some commentators that no tax be levied on withdrawals from the savings pot, or in some cases, the commentators indicated that they preferred that withdrawals from the savings pot be taxed according to the pre-retirement lump sum tables. We did not accept these comments. Our view is, and we explained this in the discussion document, that those withdrawals should ideally be taxed at marginal rates, if appropriate. And it was actually supported by a number of commentators to the discussion paper. The pre-retirement lump sum tables in particular can sometimes give the impression that pre-retirement withdrawals attract lower rates. The maximum rate is 36%, not 45%, and that is lower than other income sources. And this is in addition to the generous contribution deductions. So the main aim of retirement savings is income replacement, and in some cases income moving to meet our basic expenditure needs, particularly in old age. Set of reforms enables some level of income smoothing even before retirement. I think that is the main aim of the reform. And this means that withdrawals from the saving pot is taxed in exactly the same way as any other source of income, as soon as they become disposable in the hands of the taxpayer. So that is a basic principle at work here. Practically, if the withdrawals from the saving pot come at a time when there's a pressure on that member's income, so say, for instance, the income is lost due to retrenchment or resignation, it would mean that the replacement of that income is then taxed at either exactly the same rate, or in some cases it may even be a lower rate. If the withdrawal comes at a time when their full income is still intact, but their expenditure rose unexpectedly, then our main aim is to ensure that the withdrawal still attracts the exact appropriate level of tax that is disposable in the hands of the taxpayer. Thank you. There was a comment that tax withholding by fund administrators of withdrawals from the savings pot would require enablement through the fourth schedule, so similar to the pay-as-you-earn system, and it is advisable that there be a similar rate structure. We accept this comment, and we'll propose changes to the draft revenue laws amendment bill to allow for the administrative mechanism, and for that mechanism to be similar to the current applicable effective tax rates, which are communicated by SARS to different fund administrators in the case of taxpayers who receive more than one pension income. So we'll be extending a system that is already in use. It's not a new system. It was proposed that withdrawals from the saving pot the withholding be taxed at a flat rate, and that members then adjust with extra payment on assessment. We do not accept this proposal. We think that would lead to large assessment payments by members who make withdrawals, and we prefer to have the withholding at the correct rate as far as possible from the start. Then it was not clear to commentators why the savings pot should also be subject to the three-year waiting period for a taxpayer that ceases residence in South Africa. because the savings pot is meant to be available at any time. And we accept this comment. We will amend the bill so that there's parity with the domestic treatment so that the withdrawals can be made immediately, but then always with a period of at least 12 months between withdrawals and then similar to domestic treatment, it will also be taxed at marginal rate.
With the domestic treatment so that thank you. The withdrawals can be made immediately, but
there were comments that indicated that members who are over 55 years of age on what is colloquially known as the annuitization reform date, 1st of March of 2021, may well have need for a savings pot, but the draft legislation has protected their vested rights under the annuitization reform, but that means that they are restricted to make their contributions to sort of the previous form of the Provident Fund, and that cannot have savings pots. Indeed, it is a large lump sum withdrawal that is enabled through that vesting. We note the comment. We think that if one of these members has need for a savings pot, their preference will require a choice from that member with regard to their continued membership of the vested Provident Fund. If the fund doesn't meet their needs anymore, if this 100% lump sum payout on retirement is not what they require in their situation, then it means that they effectively need a different product. If the savings pot is preferred, then the member will need to select a new product with such a feature. So the draft Revenue Laws Amendment Bill will be amended to enable that transfer. And this enablement can, however, not provide for early withdrawals from a savings pot because there isn't a savings pot in the current product. In the absence of preservation. Then three more technical comments. The naming conventions utilized for the various pots in the reform need to be reconsidered as the current names run the risk of creating confusion. Confusion should be avoided at all costs. The addition of further new definitions may therefore be required to mitigate the risk of causing confusion, and we note this. We also acknowledge that what we refer to as POTS in the Draft Revenue Laws Amendment Bill is meant to encompass the different pots within a different fund. So these are components of a single member's retirement interest. And we will consider an adjustment in the name to reflect this component nature. And further to the above, additional definitions to clarify that and where necessary will also be incorporated. And we will consider an adjustment in the name to reflect. Then a technical comment about the drafting of the definition of savings pot, savings withdrawal benefit, and the retirement pot, that it may require some reworking to ensure that the policy intent is correctly reflected in the legislation, and that will also be clarified in the bill. Then the proposed amendments, there were proposed amendments to the second schedule, which deals with lump sums in the Income Tax Act, and some commentators felt that it was unnecessary as the current second schedule provision sufficiently cater for all the envisaged transfers. We are of the view that under the current second schedule provisions, there are no limits imposed on the proportions that can be transferred from one fund to another. So as a result, the member can potentially split their retirement interest into smaller balances and transfers into separate funds and then potentially fall under the de minimis rule. So under the two-pot regime, when transferring from one pot to another, the full value of the transferer pot, so the pot that is being transferred, should be transferred into the intended new pot. Under the two pots and should not be split into smaller pieces. So we don't think it would be wise for us to delete those provisions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. We've come to the end of our presentation. We welcome any questions, Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. We've come to the end of our presentation. We welcome any questions.
Thank you very much. And should not be split into smaller pieces.
Thank you, Chair. So we've come to the end of our presentation.
It would be wise for us.
We welcome any questions.
Thank you very much.
It seems like the Chair lost connection. Is Ms. Abraham perhaps available?
Okay. Thank you so much, Yanga, and your team for the work that you have done. And I think
Ms. Abraham,
at this time, honorable members, we will allow...
Sorry, Ms. Abraham. Maybe I should just flag the agenda for today. Sorry, I'm just going to share my screen. Just give me a second. We are allowing participants of the meeting last week to
okay, hold up.
Yeah, so I'm just going to flag the agenda quickly. Hold on a second. Can you see the screen?
Thank you so much, Alan. Comments from participants. All right, Kosatu, can you make your comments? Thank you. Thank you, Alan.
Okay. All right. No, thanks. Thanks very much, Chair. Yeah, good morning to members, the colleagues. I think we want to kind of really appreciate this response from colleagues in National Treasury. I think it's quite helpful on many fronts.
Thank you, Alan.
The one area of concern, Chair, and one appreciates the need to do a fair amount of work, and it's still a significant amount of consultation. But I think the one concern is around postponing the implementation date from March next year until March 2024. The concern being twofold. One is that workers, you know, are highly indebted. If you look at the NCR debt level studies, most workers are drowning in debt. Many workers have been kind of very anxiously waiting for implementation next year. This has been, you know, a discussion for the past 2.5 years. But one appreciates, you know, Treasury's giving space for additional consultation, et cetera, and to find the kind of resolve the remaining areas of concern in different parties, including ourselves as Labour. Perhaps, Chair, maybe a compromise could be to say, could we look at implementation from October next year? And Chair, just into the seating proposal from Treasury, I think we really want to welcome that, to provide some immediate relief to workers who are really drowning in debt, highly indebted. And I think we could have some bilateral discussion with colleagues in Treasury about the details, but I think we want to really welcome that as a very positive response to the kind of immediate relief concerns we had raised, and we think that's going to help to avoid people resigning when it comes to effects. I think that's a very positive response from Treasury colleagues. On the GEPF issue, again, perhaps let's have some bilateral discussions offline, but I'm not sure why would we need to increase contributions when most of us are under the belief that the GEPF has been actually been overfunded. But again, you know, consultations can maybe have find consensus. But I think as long as we still have this overarching amendment bill, which covers both public and private sector pension fund members, Chair, I think we want to welcome the comment from Treasury that this ideas for the two-part regime participation by pension funds be mandatory. I think that's positive. And I think also the tax incentives of the pension funds to join it is welcome. I think we also want to welcome, Chair, the options for persons who are over 55 years of age to continue the with their vested pots or to opt in. I think that's also a positive approach. And of course, to welcome the need to include monies owed for maintenance payments or for loans, etc. I think no one can contest that, but that's also critical for women who have been divorced, etc. Then, Chair, just another issue around the revenue bill. In terms of the retrenchment, I think it's positive that Treasury is looking at and responding to our request for persons who have been retrenched to still have access to the full pension funds, minus tax deductions, of course. And I think there's some useful things. I think for us, the major thing is that there's an agreement on the principle, which is critical. We can kind of engage and look at options around modalities. Be it the time frames, the UF, etc. We just bear in mind the merits and demerits. For example, the UF payment has a salary cap of about 224,000 rand a year, and it goes up to about, I think, is it 54% of a salary. But I think those are modalities. We can look at the different options. And also, we should just bear in mind there is about 4 million workers who are not currently covered by the UF because of the nature of their job, atypical work, et cetera. But I think those modalities, and one can look at it as long as you have an agreement that people who are retrenched should be given some assistance. So to avoid them, for example, not being able to feed the families, or avoid them losing out of the home because they can no longer maintain their home loan payments. Chair, I think we should also just, in the same principle, include persons who are dismissed as well. But I think it's one of the same. Persons who lose their job, so to avoid them, whether they're dismissed or retrenched, almost the same thing. Same principles. Chair, just on the issue of resignations, perhaps we should, and I know it's a difficult juggling act because Treasury wants to say they want to avoid, in exchange for giving people access, to avoid people resigning simply to cash out. We might want to consider, for example, how do you accommodate or resolve what is often called forced resignations. So, for example, a married couple live in the Eastern Cape. The husband gets a job in Cape Town. The wife, in effect, is forced to resign from her job in the Eastern Cape to join the husband because they can't afford to split the family, etc. But perhaps we could, through some bilateral discussions, kind of brainstorm a bit what could be the fair balance to avoid unnecessary resignations, but to accommodate forced resignations, for example. But I think there is progress in that regard. I think we want to really appreciate the kind of effort by Treasury to address our concerns. Then just lastly, Chair, on the rates bill, we had kind of raised a couple of quick points. We had welcomed the relief given on the fuel taxes to consumers, to the economy, over the period of April to August. That is a positive effort by government to help cushion workers and commuters and the economy from the effect of the fuel price hikes. But I think just to raise maybe three issues. In 2018, the then Minister of Energy, Jeff Kadebe, had made a commitment by January 2019 to release a fuel price or fuel tax regime review. Ministers of Finance and Minerals and Energy Resources have made a similar commitment in April this year, that by around August there will be a such a review. We haven't seen it yet. So I think we would want to have that kind of equipment, that review should be released. There should be some engagements over the next, or the remaining quarter of this year, perhaps. We think there is some space to give some reduction of fuel tax, because really, yes, we've had two reductions, but still fuel prices are at all-time high, really suffocating the economy. And there is some space with the tax level of about 32%. But of course, you would need to have some discussion with SARS about how to offset any loss of revenue for the state. Chair, just lastly on the fuel price regime is that, and I know it's outside of Treasury's mandate, but perhaps for the members, in terms of the committee report going to the House, is that we would really want to see the Department of Transport retable the RAF and the RAPS bills at Parliament, because those are going to set the RAF on a sustainable financial trajectory. That is also going to help lessen the need for these huge bailouts from the fuel levy, and also give some relief to consumers and to workers in the economy. So I think that's it from our side, Chair. I know you've just given us 5 minutes, and I think I would want to really welcome Treasury's positive responses, and perhaps we could have some bilaterals with them over the next, week or 2 weeks, and then kind of give feedback to the members in the committee. But I think you'll appreciate the positive responses from their side, Chair. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Matthew. Thank you so much. General satisfaction with a few reservations. Thank you so much, Pata. Over to you.
Appreciate the positive responses from their side, Chair. Thanks very much.
Yes, anyone from Bata? Thank you, Matthew.
Can you hear
thank
me, Chair?
So much. I can hear you. Thank you so much. You can show
a few reservations. Yes, thank you, Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to respond to the National Treasury's comments. Our comments will be very short as we haven't had much time to review the comments.
I can hear you. Thank you so much.
We'd just like to start off by saying we also like to thank National Treasury for the comments. And in the main, we eagerly look forward to the excise review that is imminent, so we can further explore some of the issues that have been raised and those that we have raised. And together, we think that we can review some of the research that is available that can possibly bring us together in terms of a constructive discussion around some of the issues related to weighted average price and price, etc. But we also still have this opportunity. It would be remiss of us if we did not spend a little bit of time of in terms of clarifying the issue around absorption related to weighted average price. At the time, there was no enforcement or very little enforcement action against the illicit trade or illicit pricing. So as an industry, we could not just stand by and watch our consumers choose illicit products and engage in criminality. So we use the only tools that were in our control, which is pricing. However, and I must state this, is that we could only do this for a period of 1 year, as the devastating impact of holding back the excise increases on our financials was too great. So what resulted in that is that the following years, the only action that we could take was then to pass on the excise increase to our consumers, and that we needed to trust in SARS and Treasury to make sure that they bring a end to illicit activity and bring a level playing field. However, where we are right now is that the effects of the past couple of years have fundamentally changed the tobacco excise policy landscape. As such, the excise review is very necessary and very central to the future of the industry, and we welcome the imminent discussion document. The only question that we would have for Treasury is when they say imminent, what time frame are we talking about? So we as industry can make sure that we are prepared for the conversation that's going to be taken. And we welcome the imminent discussion document. The only question that we would have for Treasury.
Thank you so much, Basta. Seika, can you get the rep from Seika to take over?
Thank you, Honourable Chair, and hello, Honourable Members. I'm going to be short this time. Thank you for the feedback to National Treasury for taking our comments on board. Our comments were limited to the retirement, the two-pot retirement system. So yes, as Kusata mentioned, I think it's really welcomed. However, there is a concern, obviously, that this would have been preferable earlier, but we'd rather have a well-thought-through system that functions optimally and is administratively easy to administer, rather than having something pushed through just for the sake of providing access to the funds. So we do welcome the changes. I think if you look at it, approximately 80% of the comments noted have been accepted by National Treasury. So there clearly is a need to redraft the legislation to cater for the concerns that were raised. So our concern, I think the only one that we for this two, the first one is on the defined benefit funds, as Kusata mentioned. There is a bit of a concern there about the increase in the taxpayers' contributions that may be required, but we'll be obviously looking at that during the discussions with National Treasury. The other one was the welcome clarification on the taxation of the withdrawals of the savings pot. So when you withdraw from the savings pot, how will that be taxed? So that I understand now will follow the normal procedure where you request the directive, I think, from SARS to tell you what rate of tax you need to withdraw rather than having it having a huge adjustment on assessment. So this is welcomed. However, if everybody does start accessing their 2,000 Rand per year, it could be quite an admin burden. There are currently concerns with the directive process, so hopefully all systems will be up and running and people will be capable of providing that information on a timely basis to the employers. Other than that, I think Kusata mentioned the other concerns, and I think we look forward to future consultations on this and looking at the draft bill that will be released with a lot of these changes and discussing it at that stage, because there is a lot of technical amendments that will be necessary, and once we have those, we will discuss these with Treasury. But thank you to all, and we look forward to the proposed changes. Thank you.
Thank you so much. much appreciated. We'll now get a sister as the last one. Alan, if there are any other stakeholders that are available to make presentations or respond.
Thank you very much. Thank you to National Treasury. It's a very, very encouraging response. Treasury have clearly considered the issues very carefully, and that really is sincerely appreciated. I'm very pleased to hear that the various issues are to be clarified in the draft bill, and we look forward to publication of the revised draft so that we can see exactly what the new wording is going to entail and therefore what's going to be required. I'm also very, very encouraged to hear that there are certain aspects that are going to be subject to consultation, such as the application to defined benefit funds and legacy RA funds. We look forward to those consultations. And of course, the pension fund amendments are still to be published and obviously consulted on. We look forward to those consultations as well. And so very encouraging. Thank you very much. But it's clear that there's still a lot of work to be done and to be finalized. So unfortunately, the implementation date of 1 March 2024 is still very ambitious. I think probably too ambitious. It's only once all of the legislation is final and it's published, that is, that it's 100% certain that all of the work required by retirement funds can get going, not least of which is communicating with and explaining and making sure that members, fund members, understand all of this. You know, when there's uncertainty, you cannot communicate. It just confuses people if it's not clear to them. Take, for example, the what will apply on retrenchment. We perfectly understand the issues that retrenched members experience and their desire to be able to get some capital out of the retirement fund to assist them in those circumstances, as they have always been able to do. However, we need to understand what the detail is going to be around that to add to introduce those requirements into the system. Nothing like that exists at the moment with all the various provisions and conditions and things that will have to be taken into account. All of that adds to complexity for administration, for system development, for rule amendment, all of that sort of thing. And most important, the correct, certain, final rules need to be communicated to members so that they understand. And there's no disappointment or frustration or despair if they are retrenched and they didn't understand that was going to be the outcome. So thank you very much. But as I said previously, with the best will in the world, I have my doubts that even because of all the outstanding issues that still need to be resolved, we still don't know how a lot of elements of this two-pot system are in fact going to be finalized. I'm simply cautioning that I'm not sure that 1 March 2024 is going to be doable. But thank you very much.
Thank you so much for the responses. And I think there's a lot of satisfactory work done by Treasury in terms of responding to the concerns that were raised by the stakeholders. We believe as the committee that the stakeholders are only a very, very tiny fraction of what the public out there wants to say, and therefore what you present to us and Treasury is valuable, because we believe that you carry on your shoulders the millions of South Africans out there who do not at this point in time have the opportunity to be here and speak for themselves. Thank you so much. And now, can I quickly give over to members in terms of opportunity, the agenda,
and speak for themselves.
Honorable Dion George, you can come in. Over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I want to ask a question to the Treasury, actually. I mean, it's very clear, especially if you look at the retirement funding. I mean, there's lots that needs to still happen. And as mentioned by ACESA, that, you know, March next year certainly doesn't look doable. I think even Kosatu said that, you know, maybe October would be a possible date. But I think what we need to get from the Treasury is a clear indication and timeline of when they are going to iron out all of the queries that have been raised, because it is a complex situation. And it is very clear from CISA that the industry is going to have to make very significant changes to their systems, processes, etc. And that is not an easy undertaking. So I think that we need to know from the Treasury is what their timeline is to be clear about some of the items that were mentioned today that still need to be considered, investigated, or further clarified. Because I think that would then give us a better indication of what is in fact doable. Thank you, Chair. About some of the items that were mentioned today that
thank you so much, Honorable Judge.
I think that would then give us a better indication of what is in fact.
I cannot see any more members' hands on the platform. And I think, Treasury, you can make a few comments, just maybe on the issues that the stakeholders have raised in response. And what Honorable George has also raised. Over to you, Yanga.
Thank you, Chair. I will respond on the issues that Honorable George has raised regarding the process, as well as other issues. But my colleagues will also respond on other issues, like Alvina is also here. In terms of the process, Honorable Member, during the public workshop, we told the stakeholders that after the draft response document, we're going to revise the bill and then have meetings with them to ensure that we have taken into account their comments and some of the issues are clarified. Because the public workshop assisted us as well as the written comments that they submitted to us, they are so clear. So from here, we're going to revise the bill, have another meeting with the taxpayers. But as indicated on the slide regarding the postponement, we propose that the implementation date be postponed from 1 March 2023 to 1 March 2024, because we think that by 1 March 2024, we would have done everything. Thank you. Over to you, Alvina.
We propose that the implementation date be postponed from 1 March 2023 to 1 March 2024, because we think that by 1 March 2024...
I think, Yanga, you also assist me here, because depending on the consultation process that we have with industry, with the relevant stakeholders, especially defined benefit funds, including the amendments to the Pension Funds Act and getting that into the legislative cycle. So that's what's giving me difficulty in terms of pronouncing the time frame. Because there are those factors you need to consider. Consulting with the relevant stakeholders on the proposals or the response that we have now tabled today, because initially, we didn't have seeding before. We need to work out how seeding would now be catered in the legislation and what relevant amounts of seeding we allow. Engage on those and then engage on the subsequent amendments to the bill, including the Pension Funds Act amendments. What relevant amounts of seeding we allow. So I honestly cannot confirm the finalization of these processes at this stage. Thanks. The Pension Funds Act amendments.
Fair enough.
So I
honestly can are we getting somebody else younger?
Finalization of these processes.
Chris, do you want to come in or Franz?
I'm fine, thank you, younger.
Franz, anything regarding the system?
Thank you, Yanga. I think this is something that is going to need to be discussed, but I would caution that the system implications should not be understated, but equally they shouldn't be overstated either. And we're going to have to work quite hard to find a balance between conservatism and optimism to ensure that we come up with the right answer. And I think that is why we've penciled in the 1st of March 2024. But clearly that's going to be subject to the discussions we're still going to be having with stakeholders. Thank you. Conservatism and optimism to ensure that we come
thank
up
you,
with Frank. The right answer.
And no more comments, Chair.
Penciled in the 1st of March 2024.
Okay, thank you so much, Yanga and team. I don't see hands from the side of the members either. I hope Honorable George is covered satisfactorily. And Alan, are there any announcements from your side in terms of a future meeting?
Yes, Sai Ramos, tomorrow is the feedback session on T-Lab and Tala. I will create the link and send out the agenda in the next hour or two. There are some stakeholders on here that will be present tomorrow as well. So that's it. No, thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Ellen. And let me take this opportunity and thank all the members who have made the effort to be here in this meeting. And I want to thank the stakeholders. I want to repeat that for me, you have all the taxpayers standing on your shoulders and the participation that you are making in this particular instance is valuable, not only to yourselves, but to the rest of the other taxpayers in the country. And we want to thank the team from National Treasury. Yanga, thank you so much, yourself, together with your team and the people, from the various stakeholders of National Treasury. We thank you so much. We thank the parliamentary staff for making the effort to guide us in this process. Thank you so much, honorable members. The meeting stands adjourned. We will see you tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Yanga. Parliamentary staff for making the effort to guide us in this process. Thank you so much, honorable members. The meeting stands adjourned. We will see you tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Yanga. Parliamentary staff for making the effort to guide us in this process. Thank you so much, honorable members. The meeting stands adjourned. We will see you tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Yanga. Parliamentary making the effort to guide us in this process. Thank you so much, honorable members. The meeting stands adjourned. We will see you tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.